Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show, on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Now, we're reaching way back here to bring you Howard Zinn from 2004. Howard Zinn is best known for his work, A People's History of the United States, which explains the history of our country from the perspective of outsiders, the powerless, disenfranchised, communities of color, perspectives which are typically not recognized in most textbooks. In this particular program, we talked about his inspiration behind that text, as well as his work, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. We bring you the great late Howard Zinn. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. My guest this hour is Howard Zinn. He's the acclaimed social critic, historian, and playwright, professor emeritus of Boston University, most widely known for his revolutionary work, A People's History of the United States, from 1492 to the present, which was first published in 1980, which explains history from the perspective of the powerless, the disenfranchised, and the outsiders, a perspective often ignored in most textbooks. He's also been at the forefront of the civil rights and anti-war movements, and movements for social change in this country. His most recent works include Voices of the People's History of the United States, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, his memoir, The Zinn Reader, The Future of History, interviews with David Barsamian, and the play Marx in Soho. And Howard Zinn, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you back on the air with us.
Oh, thank you.
Howard Zinn, I have not read it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, your memoir.
Oh, you haven't read it yet.
I'm sorry.
A confession, okay.
It is a confession. I've read everything else here, but I haven't read that. I apologize. But
no, that's okay. I reluctantly accept your apology.
Thank you so much. But I'm also just fascinated by the concept of you can't be neutral in a moving train and your life and how it started and why you look at it that way.
Let me first explain the title.
Sure, please.
You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, because it's, you know, some people are mystified by the title. I don't know why. I mean, it seems so obvious to me, but no. I used to I should tell my classes when I started out, very first day of class, I would say, you know, this is not going to be a neutral class. This is not going to be one of those classes where you spend a semester or year with a teacher, and at the end of the semester year, you don't know where that teacher stands on the important issues of the day. And I was saying to them that the truth is you can't really be neutral because the world is already moving in certain directions. Things are already happening. Wars are going on. Kids are going hungry. And to stand off from this, to pretend to neutrality in this, is to collaborate in whatever is happening and whatever is going on, to collaborate with war, with starvation. And therefore, I did not want to be a collaborator in that terrible sense of the word in which it was used in World War II, you know, to collaborate with fascism. I didn't want to be a collaborator, and so I was not going to be neutral. So that's the idea, really, of the book. The whole book is to explain the title.
No, I have read at least five or six times The People's History of the United States. I think I had A for that maybe, but I...
You've read it more often than I have.
Well, it's one of our family presents. My girlfriend always says, we have to give this book out every Christmas to people. It's her. Oh. She's taught me to do that.
But, that's nice of her.
I want to talk just a bit about the focus of that book, because for those who haven't read it, I think that it's important to kind of talk about how you approach history and why this book has been some ways so controversial but and so important in my... In terms of how we look at American history?
Well, the idea of the book is simply to, I say simply, but it's not simple, of course, the idea of the book is to look at American history not from the viewpoint of the founding fathers, of the presidents, of Congress, of the Supreme Court, of the, our industrial leaders or our military leaders. In other words, my idea was that history education, as it has been in this country, has mostly looked at history from the top, from the people in power, the people in authority, and has omitted the point of view of the people below, omitted the point of view of the Indians in discussing Columbus's coming to this hemisphere, omitted the viewpoint of the working people who signed up in the Revolutionary War really because they felt they had no life for them, in the way that soldiers very often sign up for the military because, you know, they don't find an alternative in civilian life.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to look at the Revolutionary War from the point of view of ordinary people, wanted to look at the Constitution, not from the point of view of Madison and Jefferson and Franklin, but from the point of view of, let's say, the farmers of Western Massachusetts who were rebelling against the rich and who were in control of the Massachusetts legislature, and whose rebellion, in fact, scared the founding fathers into deciding to have a constitutional convention and to create a kind of strong central law and order government. I wanted to tell a story of our wars.
Please.
From the standpoint of the people who suffer in the wars, not the military heroes, but the GIs on our side, the who in the Mexican War deserted in great numbers when they found out what they were doing. I also wanted to tell a story of American foreign policy from the standpoint of people in other countries who are the victims of that foreign policy. And, you know, I wanted to talk about American history from the standpoint of women, of black people, of Latino people, you know, of gays and lesbians, of dissenters and dissidents of all kinds. In other words, those people's point of view is really missing from traditional American history.
What you're also speaking to here is this, America has this almost, has a duality, has a double consciousness about itself. I mean, and you're talking about one level of looking at American democracy, but other people are often talking about another. I mean, and I wonder if you could talk about that in terms of how you view how America has changed over 200 years, what has pushed it to change.
Well, you know, the change, I mean, you know, there are two levels of change going on. One is, and you were referring to this, you know, when you talked about sort of the, you might say, a bifocal understanding of American history.
Mm-hmm.
The two levels of change going on simultaneously. One is the more obvious change that takes place as the country grows, as it expands, as it becomes an enormous economic entity, the most powerful, the richest country in the world. That is the change that is most noticed, most talked about. The United States, you know, starting with a little straggling bunch of colonies along the East Coast and becoming a world power. Then there's another kind of change, a change which is absolutely necessary because that growth that I just spoke about, that expansion, that development into a world power, really doesn't take into account what is the human cost of that expansion. What is the human cost of building a great empire? What is the human cost of the economic progress that we are so proud of? So on the other side, the other change that takes place is the change that takes place as a result of what ordinary people do. Let's say the change in the conditions of workers, which is done, which happens not because of the initiation of the presidents or the congresses or the courts, but the 8-hour day, for instance, is a change in the conditions of workers from the 10-hour day and the 12-hour day and the 14-hour day. And it's a change that takes place because working people, recognizing that the traditional, you know, institutions of government are not going to help them, that there's nothing in the Constitution that guarantees economic rights, the workers take it unto themselves. They organize, they form unions, they go out on strike, they face the police, they face the National Guard, and they win the 8-hour day. Now, that's one kind of change. The other kind of change is what happens in the racial equality. the drive for racial equality in this country, which comes about not because of the initiative of the national government, but it comes about because of movements of citizens. That is, the anti-slavery movement before the Civil War is what propels the government into the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments, not Lincoln and the Congress, although they reacted and they responded at a certain point in history. And the change that takes place in the ending of racial segregation in the South and takes place, again, not as a result of what the government does, but as a result of what black people in the South do when they decide they are just sick and tired of dealing with their humiliation, and they organize and they sit in and they go on freedom rides and they parade and they go to jail and they are beaten and some of them killed. But in the course of it, they change the South and they change the nation in a significant way. So, yes, there are two kinds of ways in which the country changes. And I say, you know, one of them is what you see at the top and what is represented by phrases like the gross national product or the Dow Jones average. And the other change is represented by how do people live and how many hours do we work and what wages do we get and are we going to be discriminated against when we walk into this restaurant? And as a woman, am I going to face the society that treats me as an inferior being? That's the second and most important kind of change that takes place in the history of this country.
My guest this hour is Howard Zinn. His most popular work and most well-known work, A People's History of the United States, 1492 to the Present, Professor Emeritus of History at American University. Howard Zinn, I was thinking about reading your book and looking again last night at the people's history, at different pieces of our history through your eyes. And, I mean, it seems to me that America has periods, let's say like the 1860s and the 1960s, where great change happened. You had the abolitionists, and then there was a civil war and the Reconstruction. But then all of a sudden came this explosion called segregation and Plessy versus Ferguson. And America, even though it pushed forward, then kind of forced its reaction, pulled the country backward. Then you had the 1960s with, you know, the pro-choice movement, the end of segregation, the social-cultural changes out of the anti-war movement, but then you seem to be America settles into a period of its opposite. And is that how you view American history? As kind of a progressive push that pushes America in one direction, but then after that there are these kind of forces that stop it. And I think actually we have to take a break here, don't we? We'll take a short break and let you answer that when we come back. Is that okay?
Oh, sure.
We'll be right back with Howard Zinn. Okay. People's History of the United States, of course, is his most famous work. So stay with us as we talk with Howard Zinn. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. My guest this hour is Howard Zinn. His most widely known work, A People's History of the United States, 1492 to the present. We'll read a couple of emails that have come in, go to the phones in a couple of minutes, and Mike in Roland Park is our first caller. Let's go back to the question we left off with Howard Zinn, whether or not you see America as this in our history is progressive forces pushing and forcing change in America, but then periods of reaction right after that.
Yes, well, you know, sometimes people look at that is, they look at this back and forth of progress and reaction, and they come to a rather pessimistic conclusion that you can't make progress, that that you're simply going round and round and round in a
circle.
Can't be
sustained,
but I don't think that's what actually happens historically. I think of it more as a kind of a spiral, you know, that goes around and stops at different places, and that may go back and forth in a kind of zigzag way. But that the general movement, I think, is a progressive one. Let me suggest this, for instance, that I think that take the example that you were referring to, and that is here we have the results of the Civil War, which in the kind of atmosphere of abolition and anti-slavery sentiment, In that atmosphere, Congress passes the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, mm-hmm. and for the first time, black people in the South vote, and they elect members, they elect African-Americans to state legislatures, to Congress, and even to the United States Senate, there's this brief period of what is called radical Reconstruction, in which we have sort of glimpses of what an egalitarian society in the South might be like. But it only lasts a few years, and it's pushed back, and the African-American members of the legislatures are forced out of and expelled from the legislative bodies. And the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are made meaningless because black people are still in semi-slavery, and the courts interpret the 14th Amendment as protecting corporations but not black people. And so you're going back, and then you have really tight and cruel racial segregation for decades and decades in the South and in the North, too. And then come the 60s, and then comes the Civil Rights Revolution, and things move forward, and they move forward beyond where they moved in the period after the Civil War, because that only lasted a few years. But the accomplishments of the 60s, the accomplishments of the Civil Rights Movement, have lasted for years. They haven't solved the problem of racism in the United States. They haven't even solved the problem of segregated schools, certainly not the problem of segregated housing and segregated neighborhoods. But we are beyond where we were in the 1950s. That's how progress comes. There's a consciousness about race today in the United States that did not exist 30 or 40 years ago. And I think you can find this true, generally, in all areas of American life where injustice exists, where people struggle against it, they win some victories, they're set back, and then they come back again and move forward again. You take the issue of women's rights and sexual equality, which came to life in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. and there's been a kind of backlash against it and an attempt, for instance, to weaken the rights won by women in the Supreme Court decision of Roe v. Wade, but they haven't been able to move it all the way back, and they haven't moved the struggle of women for equality. They haven't moved it all the way back. They've tried and they pushed, but there's an understanding and a consciousness of the rights of women today in the United States that simply did not exist 30 or 40 years ago. And I think, I would say this. In the area of foreign policy, for instance, we were at a high point in the development of anti-war feeling in the United States as a result of the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd reached a point where the American people were simply not going to countenance another war. And what has happened now is that administration after administration since the end of the Vietnam War has tried to, as they put it, bury the Vietnam syndrome. And really what they've tried to do is get Americans to accept war. And so they did it by creating very sort of successful little wars in Grenada, in Panama, in Iraq, picking on weak little countries and winning wars and making war palatable once again. And this is what has happened now in the present war in Iraq. And yet, it only works for a while. And what we've seen, for instance, now in this war in Iraq, is that when the war began, 75% of the American people were behind the war, in favor of the war. They'd been propagandized by the government. They were put in a state of fear about 9/11 and terrorism, and they went along with the Bush administration. Today, it's not 75% in favor of the war. It's more like somewhere between 45% and 49% mm-hmm. favor of the war. In other words, the sort of fundamental decent feelings of the people can be suppressed, but it comes back. The fundamental desire of people for peace, the fundamental feeling that people have, which is a revulsion against war and violence. It can be distorted for a while by the media and by the government, but I think it comes to the fore. And I think we should take some hope in that.
My guest this hour is Howard Zinn. Let's go to the phones and open them up. And Mike in Roland Park, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Hi, Mike.
And good afternoon, Professor Zinn.
Good afternoon.
I want to ask, since I have followed your career and writing, not as diligently as Mark. I've read your book less than six times. I want to confess that from the outset. On the other hand, I care about it enough that I want to ask you to apply, as a historian, your estimation of the current situation, where it's easy to say it's reactionary. In fact, I don't think there has been a time in our history where three branches of government were controlled by reaction since the defeat of Reconstruction. I think you really have to go back that far. But so the reactionary, sure, why not? I'm afraid it's worse than that, and this is what I want you to comment on. I think it's revolutionary in that they're not trying to go back to a status quo ante. They're not trying to stop change from taking place. They're trying to abolish the social services and conditions of life that people require in living in an industrial society. And I want to hear what you got to say. I'll get off.
Thank you, Mike. Howard Zinn?
Yeah, well, Mike, I understand your point, and I understand your concern, and I think you are right in saying that while we've had conservative governments, we've had reactionary governments, we've always had governments that in one way or another serve the interests of the wealthy and powerful, but this is the worst government that we have had. This is a government that is closely allied with the most wealthy interests of the country, unashamedly, and which, as you point out, has taken control of all three branches of government. And of course, does not have an opposition worth speaking of, has a Democratic Party which is pitiful in its opposition to what is going on. So you're right. It's not, you know, simply going back a little ways. They're trying to push things back beyond where they got to be in the 1930s when we had Social Security and unemployment insurance and housing subsidies. Now, that process, you might also recognize, that process began before the present administration of Bush. That process was beginning under Reagan, and then it continued under Clinton. Remember, it was under Clinton that a very important New Deal measure, the aid to families with dependent children, a very important welfare measure, was abolished. So the process of trying to push things back and destroy the advances that have been made since the 1930s, that process had been going for some time, and it's being intensified by the Bush administration. So, and of course, in our foreign policy, the aggressiveness, the unilateralism, the imperialism is more blatant, more shameless, more brutal in this administration than we have seen in a very long time. So, you know, I agree with you on that. What does that mean? It means we face a more difficult problem than we have had in this country for many, many years. But despite all of that, despite this very bleak picture of where we are today, we ought to also consider that there is a huge number of people in this country who do not go along with this. The fact that Bush has taken 100% control of the branches of government doesn't mean that he has 100% control of the American people. He won his election by 51% versus 49%. Half of the American people are not in favor of the war. Consistently, public opinion polls have shown that most Americans do not want social services cut. Most Americans want to keep Social Security. Most Americans would want free universal health care for everybody. In other words, we have a disjunction between, on the one hand, the 100% power of the government taken over in the Bush administration, but on the other hand, a population which really does not go along with that. And what it means that we then that this population needs to be mobilized and organized, and if it's and if enough mobilization and organization and acts of defiance and disobedience take place, that along with the disastrous situation in Iraq and the overwhelming opposition of the rest of the world to what the Bush administration is doing, I think that is going to result in a change.
We'll be right back with Howard Zinn. People's History of the United States, of course, is his most famous work. So stay with us as we talk with Howard Zinn.
You're listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Good morning, this is Mark Steiner. Just a reminder that we are listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner.
But we have, I think at the same time, don't we have a nation as we did in this, during the Civil War, when even in the North there was a huge amount of Southern sympathy during the Civil War, that you have a nation that's very divided. You have in a very different view of what this America should look like. It's not as if the vast majority of American people are with the progressive forces or with the conservative forces, that this is a very divided nation politically.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And you might say it's a race between the two divisions of the country. It's a race to see who will prevail, whether those people who hold the power now will hold on to power, or whether we who represent a very large part of the country, and I would guess a majority of the country, that we, because remember, 40% of the people in the election did not vote at all, so that, you know, Bush actually got only like 31% of the voting population.
A plurality said no. I said a plurality said no.
Yes. Yeah, a plurality, yes, but far from a majority. And only a plurality of those who voted. But the point is that there's a huge number of people in this country who, if organized, if mobilized, if spurred on by and made indignant by what is happening to our rights and our benefits and to our young people sent abroad, if enough people begin to act, I believe this administration will at some point topple.
My guest is Howard Zinn. His book of most fame is A People's History of the United States. The many of the books he's written, things like The New Abolitionist, which inspired many of us in the early 60s, and the Civil Rights Movement, books like You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, and more. And Ellen in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Mr. Zinn. I am thrilled to be able to speak to you. I am currently reading A People's History because I recommended it to a friend, and she called me up, and she was just so thrilled, and then I felt guilty that I hadn't actually read it, so I'm reading it now.
You recommended it before you read it.
Well, you know, I've heard so much about it.
I would call that faith, yes.
And, but I have a question. You know, you talked about the two kinds of history, the people's history versus what one might call the court history of the United States. And it seems to me that, you know, you're making an argument for some sort of progressive interpretation of the people's history part. But there's also been this development of the court history part to the, you know, where we went from robber barons to international bankers, now to global corporations. And these are the people who are laying the track where that the train, you know, is moving on. And we are now at the point of an almost total dependence on the industrial globalization for a certain level of standard of life, so-called. And I wonder if the government actually admitted that we went to Iraq for geostrategic reasons and for oil, especially, and that we really need that oil in order to keep things going the way they are, whether the American people, you know, how they feel about it. Anyway, that's my question.
Okay, that's fine. At Howard Zinn, we have about 2 minutes to break. Why don't you, let me just warn you that. We'll start off. Go ahead.
Well, I think Ellen was talking about how they dominate with their court history. They dominate the educational system. But I must say there's been more and more of people's history coming out, not just my book, but lots of other work which represents a new way of looking at people's struggles of black people, of women, of working people, of gays and lesbians and so on. And I'm very hopeful when I go around the country and I see more and more teachers teaching in a different way.
It's almost time for break. We'll take us there in just a second. Let me read an email that will take us to break. And the email is from Percy in Baltimore. He says, I'm a huge fan of both Howard and Mark. Every nation has a distorted view of their own history. However, America is unique in that it's a major world power built on death and slavery. What disturbs me is that it appears that only the U.S. knows war and death. In a sense, I feel the U.S. has equated war with freedom and death, with liberation. While serving my country as an Air Force airman, I was shocked about the views and perversions of our troops when speaking about foreigners, including third world people. I'm sure that there's a sadistic joy that has minimized the effects of the destruction of African Americans and Native Americans felt during the endless atrocities in the birth of this nation. That's from one of our listeners. We'll be right back as we talk with Howard Zinn. Don't go away. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. My guest this hour is Howard Zinn, professor emeritus at Boston University. Widely renowned for his work, A People's History of the United States, 1492 to the present. It's sold over 1 million copies in the last 20-odd years. He's also written You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, The Zinn Reader, The Future of History, plays like Marx and Soho, another play called Emma, about Emma Goldman, The New Abolitionist that he wrote in the early 60s about the SNCC workers in the South. We'll come back to the phones in just a second. But first, Howard, I'd like you to take us for a second, again, a little personal journey to your own past. I mean, I've read that you worked on the docks as a young man, that you were a bombardier during World War II, serving in the Army Air Force, that you people like Alan Watts, Emma Goldman, and Upton Sinclair had profound influences on you on your thinking. Talk a bit about that in terms of your own formation of your thoughts and where Howard Zinn came from.
Well, I suppose no one ever can explain exactly how they came to the peculiar views that they hold. But I do think that the fact that I was brought up in a working class family, that I went to work at a shipyard at the age of 18, spent 3 years there, that I was in the Air Force, and that I bombed places in Europe that later I was ashamed of doing, that I began to study history and then began to teach in the South, taught in a black women's college in Atlanta, Georgia, Spelman College. I think all of those had a very profound effect, you know, on my thinking, gave me a kind of class consciousness, gave me an antipathy towards war, a feeling that war, even the so-called good war that I was in, that wars don't really solve fundamental problems, that they brutalize people, as we are seeing right now, you know, in Iraq. And I developed it by living in the South and becoming part of the movement. I learned something about democracy. I learned that democracy does not come from the government, because I could see the government, federal government, standing by while black people were being beaten in the South and prevented from voting. I discovered that democracy really comes alive only when people themselves act on their own behalf, and they organize and they struggle and they risk. In that way, my own experiences and my my personal life had an effect on my teaching, you know, and my writing. And by the way, you've given a lot of nice publicity to my book, A People's History of the United States, but I should point out that there has just emerged mysteriously from Seven Stories Press in New York a companion volume to A People's History, which I did along with Anthony Arnove, an activist and editor. It's called Voices of a People's History. And what it is, it's a compilation of the voices, of the words of fugitive slaves, of working people, of rebellious women, of socialists and anarchists and agitators and soldiers who refuse to fight in unjust wars, and a wonderful compilation of, I say wonderful, but describing a book that I worked on, that's very modest, isn't
that's
it?
That's fine. You're allowed.
I'm allowed. Okay. They are wonderful. The people we include in this book are wonderful. We, the editors, we're not much.
Spoken like how Zinn would speak it. But now, tell me, then, this book, though, are these speeches and writings that you discover from American history, or the interviews you've done, or both?
No, they're not. No, they go back to, they're like the account that Las Casas gave about what he saw Columbus do. And the voice of a Revolutionary War soldier who talks about the miserable conditions that he faced, and the speech given by Helen Keller on the eve of World War I against militarism and war, and a letter that a family after the Twin Towers of after 9/11, the Rodriguez family wrote to President Bush. Their son had been killed in the Twin Towers, and they write to President Bush, and they say, "We do not want you to respond to our son's death with retaliation and with violence." Statements like that are all through this book.
I look forward to that book.
Thanks.
I do. I really do. Let me read a couple of emails and go right back to the phones. Max Obuszewski writes in, "The Pledge of Resistance is working on a letter to go out in early 2005. It will be a call to resistance against the war and occupation of Iraq. We look forward to having Howard Zinn sign on and endorse the call for increased nonviolent civil resistance to end this bloody quagmire in Iraq." And Tim writes in, "Professor Zinn, is there a way for those of us who do not support this commercialism at all cost society, where we can just let the rich keep theirs and then ignore them? For instance, do you feel we as a people are able to discipline ourselves to shop at places such as farmers markets and small mom-and-pop stores, to transport ourselves by buses, subways, and bikes, and shut down this mega-corporate mentality? Is there hope that we can just tell our young people to say no and not join this volunteer army? Or do we have to engage the wealthy and powerful and hope they change? And if they are absolutely necessary, can they change?" That's a long question.
That's a very important very important message. It tells us that wherever we can, and we can't do it all the time because, you know, we're sort of trapped in this market, capitalist, consumer, militaristic society, but wherever we can, we should resist. Wherever we can, we should go to farmers' markets. We should try to bypass the huge... We should bypass the big bookstores and go to little neighborhood bookstores. We should talk to young people who are being seduced by or bribed by military recruiters and talk to them about war and what it does to people. In other words, there are things we can do even within this controlled society to create little circles of liberation, little oases in which we are ourselves, in which we feel that we can be human beings, despite all of that glitter and cupidity and violence around us.
My guest is Howard Zinn. Let's return to the phones. And Mark in Hamden, you're on the air.
Well, hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Professor.
Hi.
Yeah, Max. Max is right on target. I used to buy books in at the BNN on the block where CVS tore down all those beautiful buildings.
Right.
You talked about a healthcare professor.
Yes.
I just happened to read by chance a little quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Mark, I'm sorry, but we don't have a lot of time left, so I'm going to have to ask you to get a little closer to your point. I'm sorry.
Okay, my point is, Emerson said health is the first wealth. But what I wanted to say is this: that the fathers of the the makers of the creators of the Constitution firmly established the separation of church and state, And but I don't think they, I don't believe they intended separation between government, between state and just and ethical conduct. It's kind of ironic that all those pro-life people...
Mark, I'm really going to have to get to a point because we really are almost out of time here.
Can I ask a question?
That's what I want you to do, yeah.
Yeah, in terms of just and ethical conduct. What I really want to ask you is this. In terms of the embargo against Cuba, is the United States violating the Chapter 1, Article 1 and 2 of the United Nations Charter?
Well,
thank you, Mark.
Well, I would say this about the embargo in Cuba. That aside from the legal situation about whether the United States is violating a charter, the United States is simply engaging in an inhuman policy in making life difficult for the ordinary people of Cuba. And simply because the United States doesn't want Castro in power, the United States would rather have Batista in power, would rather have one of its stooges in power. And so they're punishing the people of Cuba by this embargo. I've been to Cuba, and people are remarkably resilient and hopeful, and they manage, and they have a wonderful health care system and a wonderful educational system. But the United States is trying to strangle them. And aside from the legality of the issue, the important thing is that morally it is a reprehensible thing to do, and we all should be protesting against it.
My guest is Howard Zinn. And Jerry, in Mount Washington, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Zinn. I am very much of a fan of yours. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Oh, hi, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
I will make it very brief. I know you don't have much time. I wanted to recommend the Progressive magazine, of which you are a regular,
columnist.
Regular columnist. I'm sorry, I couldn't think of the word. Okay, columnist. And it's an excellent magazine. I not only have purchased about 13 editions of People's History and have handed them around as Christmas presents, but I also give out gifts of subscriptions to that magazine. And I did want to put a plug in for it because there's not only yourself, but Will Durst and Molly Ivins and those wonderful writers, Matthew Rothschild and others. There's also a People's History of the Supreme Court by Peter Irons, which is also an excellent book as well, which sort of like a companion book to yours as well. And I just wanted to recommend this, and I want to thank you and keep up the very good work that you do.
Well, thank you.
Thank
and
you,
those are good recommendations.
I don't know those. I didn't know that last one. And Rit in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Mark.
Hi,
Britt Mitchell here, Pastor Mitchell. I'm an alumni of Boston University along with Professor Zinn. And I just wanted to make the comment and let him talk, eyeing up after this, that we that are of the justice, peace movement of the church, we are the United Church of Christ. Not only in our advertising, but in our everyday existence, we are completely blocked off the airways. The 4,000-some Christian radio TV stations will not even permit us to broadcast our worship services. So I would like to get his comment on that, if I could. And I'll just hang up and take it off the air.
Well, you know, the control of the radio stations by the fundamentalist and, I might say, fanatic right wing in the United States is really such a violation of democracy. And our only recourse, and the United Church of Christ, I guess, is in the position that all of us are who are shut out by the major media and by their control, our only recourse is to try to find alternative ways of reaching the public, alternative radio stations. And I hope the United Church of Christ will make use of NPR, will make use of alternative radio, will make use of Democracy Now!, will make use of Pacifica, will make use of the Internet. In other words, we have to bypass the major organs of communication, which are controlled by the right wing, and create our own system of communication with the American people.
We have about 2 minutes left here, Howard Zinn, but when you see the real divide in this world today, not just in America, but throughout the world of populations, the right and left, however we want to describe them, tell me about your view of where the future is going to go as a historian.
Historians know about the past. they know very little about the future. But all I can do is... all I can do is express a hope that more and more people are going to see, are seeing the futility of war, you know, that things go on and on and on and on in terrible ways, and a point is reached where people have had enough and they won't deal with it anymore. And that's why we see dictators who have been in power 30 or 40 years, they suddenly are toppled by hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. We have seen regimes change, not by military intervention abroad, but by their own people. And we've seen in Latin America governments like the Lula government in Brazil, like the Chavez government in Venezuela, governments representing workers and peasants finally get into power. I think there's hope for people in these next decades, and I really believe in the United States, which is really the embodiment of what is sort of violent and capitalistic and selfish in the world at this moment. I believe there's so many good people in the United States who want to change that we are going to bring that about at some point in the near future.
Howard Zinn, it's been a great pleasure to have you on the air with us this hour. Look forward to seeing
you
in Baltimore in a couple of days. Thank you so much. And by the way, my best to your son, Jeff, my old college classmate.
Oh, okay.
All right. Take care.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Howard Zinn was our guest this hour. A People's History of the United States was his most popular work and numerous others.